The price of oil has risen by about $10 per barrel in the past few weeks. With the price hovering around $100, Jacob Goldstein from NPR's Planet Money team explains what higher oil prices mean for us.
Here's a rough rule of thumb. When the price of oil goes up by $10 a barrel, the price of a gallon of gas goes up by about 25 cents at the pump. That's a noticeable jump when you're filling up your tank, but it isn't big enough to cause a meaningful change in how much people drive or how fuel efficient their cars are. So this rise in gas prices means people are going to spend more money on gas and less money eating out, going on vacation, etc. That in turn means we'll have slower economic growth. This is definitely bad news. Coming out of the worst recession in decades, we want more economic growth, not less. Slower economic growth means we won't add as many jobs. It means the unemployment rate will take longer to fall. Still, a $10 a barrel rise in oil prices isn't enough on its own to derail the economic recovery. Estimates suggest that this rise could shave less than half a percentage point off the economy's annual growth rate. So instead of growing at, say, 3% this year, the economy might grow at 2.7%. But if the price of oil continues to shoot up, the threat to the economic recovery will grow. Oil at $100 a barrel isn't enough to send us back into a recession, but oil at $140 or $150 a barrel might be. Jacob Goldstein, NPR News.
In his new book, West of Here, novelist Jonathan Evason takes readers back to one of the last unexplored territories of the American West, Washington State's Olympic Peninsula. It's a story about a fictional town in the Pacific Northwest, and it's told from the perspective of the people who first settled there and their modern-day counterparts who have to live with the decisions that they made. NPR's Lynn Neary says the book is a kind of conversation between past and present.
Jonathan Evason has spent most of his life hiking and camping out on the Olympic Peninsula. He understands its uncompromising beauty. He's fascinated by its history, by the people who explored the rugged terrain of the Olympic Mountains and built the towns that sit in their shadow. Evason says he wanted to write a novel about the history of the peninsula, but he didn't want to be trapped by history.
So often when we historicize material, we use this big, wide-angle lens, and the novel I wanted to write, instead of a wide-angle lens, was a kaleidoscope of clashing and overlapping first-person narratives.
So Evason began his research by poking around in the local libraries of towns up and down the Olympic Peninsula.
And I found that at all these little libraries in Port Angeles and Squim and Shelton and all these peninsula towns, you can find these wonderful little tape-bound manuscripts. Some of them are 15 pages long, some of them are 100 pages long, but they're personalized first-person accounts of frontier living.
From these first-person accounts, Evason created the cast of characters who first lived in the fictional town of Port Bonita, Washington, the Native Americans who have already been marginalized in their own homeland, the explorers who came to conquer a wilderness that had long been considered impenetrable, and the settlers who think they can impose their will on this wilderness. One of those settlers, a young man named Ethan Thornburg, arrives in town on a steamer from Seattle, ready to reinvent himself. He decides to build a dam to ensure the future of Port Bonita.
We'll transform this place, Jake, for 100 miles in every direction. Our dam will be a force of nature. Ethan unpocketed his pipe and tobacco and packed a bowl and puffed, relishing the endless possibilities of progress. A glittering city will take shape along that strait, Jake. You wait and see. And standing there on the lip of the gorge, with a stiff wind rocketing past his ears, his arm draped over the shoulder of the man whom he hoped would soon be his brother-in-law, Ethan envisioned a glorious future for Port Bonita, 20, 30, 100 years and beyond.
Evason moves the story back and forth from the past to the present, linking the actions of those who founded the town in the late 19th century with the people who still live there. As the book opens, it is 2006, and the dam, once a source of pride for Port Bonita, is being dismantled. The power harnessed by that dam did make the growth of Port Bonita possible, but the town never rose to greatness. And, says Evason, the dam wreaked havoc on the environment.
What it meant is it killed probably the greatest salmon run in the world. I mean, there used to be something, the annual salmon run up the Elwha was something like a 500,000 salmon, and it's down under 4,000 last I checked.
The town still sits on the edge of a pristine wilderness, but it's a worn-out place. The residents of Port Bonita are funny, quirky, and a little sad. Where once brave but foolhardy explorers set off to conquer the formidable Olympic Mountains, now an ex-con follows the same trail, hoping to find redemption in the wilderness. Two young Native Americans trade places, one from the past who's thought to have spiritual powers, the other a contemporary teenager strung out on drugs. And a descendant of one of the first settlers in town holds fast to his belief in the mythical creature Sasquatch. Evison says he couldn't write a novel about the Pacific Northwest without including the story of Bigfoot.
I like this idea that there's still something wild out there. I want to believe in this idea that there's still something out there we don't know about lurking in these mountains, because most of those possibilities are gone. Homesteading is gone. Most of the economic infrastructure that allowed this place to exist in the first place and the resources have all been gutted. Those possibilities are gone. Bigfoot is one of the possibilities that's still out there.
The people of Port Bonita, says Evison, have not been left much of a legacy. The dreams of their ancestors have not been fulfilled, and for the most part, neither have their own.
The potential was endless. Now the people waking up there today really have to sort of reconcile their future with their past before they can even begin again. I think the book is hopeful, ultimately. I mean, yeah, we gutted our resources. We're still forced to reckon with our early mistakes, but I still believe in the old American ethic of putting your shoulder to the wheel and figuring out where we go from here.
The story of Port Bonita, says Evison, is the story of America. And the cockeyed optimism that fueled that story lives on in the people who have inherited the pride and the pain of the past. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
And we have another story about a man from the Northwest trying to overcome the past, although there's no fiction here. Robert Soloway left the Federal Correctional Institution in Sheridan, Oregon, less than a week ago, and he is starting a new life in Seattle. If his name doesn't ring a bell, you may know him better as the Spam King.
That's the nickname he got from federal prosecutors. Soloway went to prison in 2008 for spamming, mail fraud, and tax violations. He admitted to sending more than 10 trillion spam emails and made a living showing others how to sell Viagra, and other products online. At one time, the Spam King made $20,000 a day from his underground operation. He wore Prada and drove Porsches.
10 trillion emails. He doesn't own a car anymore and works in a print shop for $10 an hour. He told Wired magazine he wants to devote his life to teaching people how to avoid cybercrime. Probation officers will monitor every email he sends and every website he visits for the next 3 years.
From NPR News, this is Morning Edition, directed by Van Williamson, Vince Pearson, and Travis Larchuk. The production staff includes Nicole Beemster-Bohr, Jess Gittner, Kevin Leahy, Chris Bendereff, Selena Simmons-Duffin, and Lindsay Toddy, with Ben Bergman, Melissa Yeager-Miller, and Sasha Woodruff here at NPR West.
Our executive producer is Madalika Sicka. The executive director of news programming is Ellen McDonald. Morning Edition's theme music was written by B.J. Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. On Fridays, we hear from StoryCorps, the oral history project that records Americans talking about their lives. Today, a conversation in Chicago. Ron and Pepper Miller met 25 years ago. They fell in love and got married, but it didn't work out. The pair recently sat down to talk about it.
I think in our marriage, it was all about you. You were the man, Mac Daddy, and I got to a point where I didn't want it to be about you. I wanted it to be about me.
I thought you were spending a lot more time on your friends than you were with our marriage.
The divorce was amicable, but we went to the same church and you moved to the other side of the church.
I did.
I felt like giving you the finger several times. You dated people and I dated other people.
But, you know, I missed you.
Remember you called me? And you had the flu,
oh, yeah.
And I came and made you soup. I remember smelling your cologne, you know, after having to tuck you in.
Yeah, we started having lunch, and I mentioned getting back together, but you said no, and something happened.
Well, it was one of my girlfriends that talked to me. She said, you know, Pepper, you are constantly comparing Ron to other people. The problem with this one, the problem with that one, is that they are not Ron. So I hung up the phone and I called you, and we started dating, and it was good. And I remember I took my dad on a cruise. I opened my suitcase and there was this long letter from you asking me to marry you. It was very romantic, and that was in August. And then December, we were married, man.
Right. 8 years the first time. We were divorced 5 years, and December it'll be 10 years we married again.
I'm still excited to be with you, snuggle with you, and smell that cologne. I mean, we still have our bumps, huh?
Oh, yeah. You know, always have our bumps, I'm sure. But we've learned that there's nobody that we'd rather be with than each other.
I love you.
And I love you, too.
Ron and Pepper Miller in Chicago. Their story will be archived at the Library of Congress.
The Environmental Protection Agency stands to lose big in the battle over the federal budget. The House already passed its version of a bill to fund the federal government for the rest of the year. It calls for big cuts in EPA programs. And as NPR's Elizabeth Shogun reports, those cuts are aimed directly at the Obama administration's environmental agenda.
The House bill would slash the EPA's budget by nearly a third, more than any other agency. It would stop the agency from regulating greenhouse gas emissions, and it would gut many other programs that prevent air and water pollution and enforce environmental laws. Representative Mike Simpson from Idaho heads the House subcommittee responsible for EPA's budget. He says he's only gotten a couple calls complaining about the cuts.
I've had substantial input from people on the other side that are concerned about the EPA and like what we're doing. They feel like we ought to rein them in some. They've gone far beyond their authority and, frankly, are costing jobs in this country.
Environmentalists say the public isn't complaining because few people have heard about the extent of the cuts. Groups like the Environmental Defense Fund are trying to spark an outcry with television ads. This one shows an ultrasound of a fetus. It quotes an American Academy of Pediatrics study warning about the risks of mercury exposure to young children.
The House sided with corporate lobbyists to block limits on mercury pollution. Did they think America wouldn't notice?
The ad is referring to new pollution standards for cement plants. An amendment added to the House bill would stop the agency from enforcing those standards. It was one of a cascade of amendments to block EPA initiatives, such as restoring the Chesapeake Bay and Florida Everglades and cleaning up coal ash waste and mountaintop coal mining. House Republicans also took aim at climate change programs across the government. Many new House Republicans deny what scientists widely accept, that climate change will have catastrophic consequences, and people are a significant cause of it. A new Republican member from Kansas, Mike Pompeo, led a drive to slash funding for an EPA program that makes businesses report their greenhouse gas pollution.
I can attest to you that this greenhouse gas registry will destroy jobs in Kansas. It will increase the cost of manufacturing for every Kansas airplane manufacturer, and it will increase the cost of energy for every Kansas family.
Some of the biggest EPA reductions would come in projects to update water treatment and sewage systems. Representative Donna Edwards is a Democrat from Maryland. She tried but failed to talk colleagues out of these cuts.
Just last month out in my district in a cold winter morning, not far from Capitol Hill, a 54-inch water main broke, created massive destruction, overturned cars, destroyed businesses, and left residents like me without safe drinking water for days.
Senate Democrats like Barbara Boxer from California say the House bill would hobble the EPA.
And it means dirty air, dirty water. It means more mercury in the air. It means more soot getting into our lungs. This is serious business.
Boxer says the Senate won't go for these cuts. She says House Republicans went way too far.
They have essentially unleashed war against the EPA, and in doing so, they are going to hurt the American people, and we have to stop it.
The battle over the EPA budget is one example of why it's so hard for Congress to agree on a plan to fund the federal government for the rest of the year. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
All Things Considered continues right after this.
Surveying the nation's job market is a bit like looking at a map on your computer screen. It's not until you zoom in that you can see the details. And when you do zoom in, you can find some very different stories. NPR's Zoe Chase went looking for people who are hiring and may have found the best job market in the country.
It's opposite day, where undergrads have their pick of jobs and companies are desperate to hire. Take Microsoft. Ederlyn Laxon was an intern there last summer.
Last year, they had a private screening of Cirque du Soleil for the interns.
Laxon is graduating this year from the University of Maryland's computer science program. She had her pick of jobs in the tech sector. Startups were courting her, big companies were flexing their muscle, hoping to impress.
It was ridiculous. There were people walking by with, like, you know, shrimp cocktails, like the unending stream of shrimp cocktails.
Laxon starts at Microsoft this fall. Her classmates got the same treatment. Ray Douglas will be working at the University of Maryland next year. The school offered him a salary in the 50s. He just happened to mention to his boss the offers he'd gotten from other firms, which were starting in the 70s and 80s.
And he said, okay, we'll beat that.
He's 22 years old.
I was just asking him. I didn't think he was going to do it.
Tech companies, both large and small, can't find enough people to fill their open jobs. The unemployment rate for tech workers is about a third less than the national average.
I hired 3 new people last week.
Jeff Winter's a recruiter in Silicon Valley. He finds people to fill these openings. It's Sisyphean. For every job the man fills, there's a need for 10 more programmers. So he hired some people to help him hire some people.
I have, right now on my desk, 12 clients with anywhere between, you know, 6 to 10 jobs apiece, it seems.
Winter says it hasn't been like this since 1999, when the dot-com bubble created a similar labor shortage. Startup companies were desperate to hire web developers. Today's companies are desperate to hire app developers. Like Unity Technologies in San Francisco, they have more than 10 openings. I asked CEO David Helgeson for a pitch.
Unity Technologies is a company that's sort of an engineering-driven company and products-driven company.
I played the pitch for the students. Ray Douglas was candid.
It sounded pretty much like every pitch that a software company has given me. They're always like, oh, we do all these fantastic things. Everyone in the world wants to use it.
Ouch. So what's a tech company to do? One thing, drop the whole years of experience requirement. That makes these jobs harder to fill. And also, you might just be embarrassing yourself, says Ederlyn Laxon.
They'll demand a skill set that, you know, for example, 10 years of experience with this programming language. I'm like, this programming language hasn't existed for 10 years.
The only thing holding back computer science majors in the job market, Laxon tells me, might be their social skills. Silicon Valley recruiter Jeff Winter says, be nice. And he could make you the next Mark Zuckerberg.
The ones that aren't nice, though, they don't get their Zuck. You know Zuck, right?
Yeah. Zuck founded Facebook.
No Zuck for you.
Don't I know it. But Facebook is looking for someone. They're hiring ahead of their IT department, and they haven't been able to find anyone. Zoe Chase, NPR News.